I'm Christopher Lydon with Gerald Shea at his home in Marblehead, Massachusetts. He's an international lawyer who has written an irresistible book of revelation called Song Without Words. It recounts his discovery about halfway through his 70 years that he was severely deaf, hearing a sort of Jabberwocky garble of nonsensical words in the classroom and the law work of his life, even in close-up intimacies with lovers and friends. But what he was really learning, I think, was to notice how his brain works, how poetry and music and conversation and the commerce of souls actually work for all of us. This is Open Source, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. This one is about the universe between your ears. It turns out, in Gerald Shea's case, that he was damaged enough by scarlet fever in childhood that he heard everything wrong. What he heard someone saying was, go to the parchment eyes of life, when in fact the man was saying, don't compartmentalize your life. Or a teacher, speaking about Ibsen, asked, whatever happens after coral reefs? What the teacher said and meant was, what'll happen after Nora leaves? When someone sang the Frank Lesser song, he heard, you are the tier two ties of a keeper of incoming loot. The lyrics are actually, you have the clear, cool eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. These were what Gerry Shea came to call the lyricals, the wrong word lyrics that became your language, Gerry Shea, but it's also a connection to poetry and a lot of other things. Speak about those lyricals, and are you still hearing them as we speak now?
Well, I do, Chris. I hear them all the time. As you know, I heard them in the car on the way over. Just as you were speaking now, or before we started, you said, let's plunge into this, and I figured out very quickly that you said, let's plunge into this. You talked about the embassies of my life, but they were the intimacies of my life. At some point, you may have missed the word yourself, but I heard someone coying for someone singing, and they just go on and on. Sometimes they're very quick, sometimes they take time to figure it out. This interview is working well because you have the light on your lips and you're only about 2 feet away from me. So sound diminishes exponentially with distance, and here we're overcoming that to some extent. But the lyricals are always there and an integral part of my life, as they have been since I was a child.
As somebody said to you once, you're a one-man United Nations sort of translation bureau. You're translating everything you hear as you go, but that's a whole lot of work, Gerry.
It's a lot of work professionally, as a lawyer, certainly, but as a writer, as someone now who's on his own and independent, it's become a kind of magical experience because I'm not being paid to hear anymore.
But there you were at Yale, 18 years old, taking notes on lectures, and the kid next to you was writing down a completely different set of words and a sense of what the professor was talking about. How could this be?
Well, I remember my first day at Yale in a large lecture hall, the instructor, the professor started speaking, and everybody picked up their pens and pencils, and I was amazed at that. And I thought to myself, what a wonderful school this is, because everybody's so smart, because I couldn't really make heads or tails out of what he was saying. So I moved to looking at the notes of my neighbors and asking questions from time to time. But for me, it was always a spiritual or intellectual perhaps problem. I thought everybody else was just like me, that they heard what I heard, but they could translate the message, and I couldn't. So really, I felt in many ways, at least academically at Yale, that I probably didn't belong there.
But everybody reads this book and says, why didn't he check? Why didn't he say, hey, what's going on here? Go to a doctor, get his ears tested. Is there a simple answer? And then I want to take a shot at my own explanation.
Sure. I think that, as a child when this happened, my world grew slowly quieter. And the consonants were disappearing. Those are high-frequency sounds. And it was a gradual loss. And I began, this really became my universe, my life, my way of living. And it simply never occurred to me that the world of other people was different from mine. So if you say, well, did they hear that when you didn't? That never would have occurred to me because I thought my world was the real world and this was everyone's universe.
But then at Yale comes the exam on the material, and you've recorded a completely different sense of what it was all about.
Oh, yeah. Well, I was at Yale, I would tend not to take notes at lectures because I simply would more or less give up. We can get to this, but it was different at law school because law school was a place where you really absolutely had to do well. Otherwise, you wouldn't get a job. At Yale, you could still read. You could read the course material, and you could get by. So when I took the examination, it would be based upon what I'd read, and I would do all right. But the lectures themselves were not informative exercises for me at all.
Jerry, try my two stabs at understanding why you didn't break out of that zone. One, that you actually, deep down somewhere, preferred the song to the words. And it was a kind of an amazing way to go through school. It was a social, singing, musical experience, not all sorts of intellectual drudgery, and maybe you got the best of it. But I know a young actor, for example, who says they're taught, forget about the words, it's the gesture, it's the body language, it's the spirit, it's the tone that will deliver the message. It seems to me you were acting that out in a kind of precocious way.
I've always loved the beauty of words, and even the non-words and wrong words of my lyricals and the nonsense that they make. And I think you're probably right. I did live in a way in my own world of poetry. Lyricals are really an unconscious poetry, like in Though the Parchment Eyes of Light or What Water Happens After Coral Reefs. And it was a life probably that I did love, even though the problem of understanding, misunderstanding, non-understanding was there. I loved my universe, and I still do.
Somewhere Robert Frost said that the essence of a poem comes through, or the message or the meaning or something comes through, as does the spirit of a conversation two rooms away. We can't hear the words, but we know the affection or the fear or the hostility or the love or the spirit of the poem by hearing some overtone. And that's what you were hearing from these lectures.
Well, that's right. You would hear the overtones of the words. Our favorite teacher, Charles Garside, I can remember. I mean, I take the example. I can't always remember my lyricals, but Charles got up there and gave his lecture on Charles V, and I heard something like, Charles endebited the minstrel stills with his automatic million, when what he really said was Charles inherited his administrative skills from the Emperor Maximilian. But how are you going to write down Charles endebited the minstrel stills, because it didn't make any sense? So finally, I'd wind up looking at Garside and his kinesic movements, you know, those are gestures accompanying speech, and simply marvel at his delivery without really knowing what he was saying.
My other general theory on reading your book is that there was a fear somewhere containing you in this universe, and somewhere Gerald Shea, at some unconscious level, didn't want to hear what people were saying to him directly. And oftentimes they were telling you how they loved you.
I think the fear was this intellectual, spiritual life of mine of incomprehension was my own private world. And I didn't want anybody to break into that world to discover it and to expose how deficient a person intellectually or spiritually I really was.
And what about the personal devotions that you were missing out on? I mean, there's a Mary Choate in the middle of this book, another Beth, people who tell you, Gerald, you're not listening, or Gerald, there's a split between what you're hearing and what you're living. And you didn't pick up on those clues at all, even though you loved those women and they loved you.
Yes. Yeah, well, in Mary's case, I clearly understood the problem, because at that point I was in law school. But I lost Mary not so much of my inability to understand her, mostly because, after all, if you're lovers and you're kissing each other and loving each other, the words aren't that important, and we're back to the importance of the tonality that Frost was talking about. I lost Mary simply because I, by the time I was in law school, devoted so much to getting the words that I really had no time for. That was the problem with Mary. But she wouldn't get me across this bridge. At that point, I was preoccupied with law and really not thinking about Mary saying, well, you're not listening. Of course I don't listen, because I don't understand. Mary, like other people, can get the message, and I can't. Mary is intellectually sharper than I am. Everybody is. I have my own private world. And as soon as Mary or Beth, another woman who started to spot the thing, we went to see The Lady and the Tramp together, and I couldn't understand the movie. I've never understood movies. As soon as somebody tried to approach my world, my private world of lyricals, I didn't call them that then, I really didn't want to let them in.
And why not?
I think because, probably because of insecurity, because of fear, because of my knowledge of myself as perhaps an incomplete human being, perhaps as someone who was at home with his own internal poetry. It was simply a world that I wanted to keep to myself. I was different from other people, and I was going to live that way and stay that way. The only area in which I really tried to conquer this intellectual problem was in the law, because I had to somehow earn my bread.
But when Beth said to you, "Jerry, your eyes and your mind go separate ways," you didn't want to pick up the Clue phone.
No, I didn't, and I didn't. I simply didn't. Again, it was my world, and didn't want to change it. Of course, my eyes and my mind did go separate ways. If you're sitting in a movie theater watching The Lady and the Tramp, and cartoons are difficult because the lips, I'm a very good lip reader because I've been doing it all my life, the lips of the characters don't really form the words. They just, the mouths open and close. And you can't understand what Lady is saying to the tramp or what all the other characters are saying. Obviously, your mind and your eyes are moving in different directions even in the movies, but when you're talking to somebody. You really don't want to go into that area of your soul where you think you're living a private, perhaps poetic life, but you're really deficient. And we can get there, but for example, I've heard buzzing, ringing in my ears ever since Scarlet Fever. I used to think they were here in Marblehead, my grandfather's house. I thought they were the sound of dragonflies, and in the different seasons, different sounds. I thought it was simply the world of nature. And when a nurse finally, when I was 33, identified the problem and asked me whether I heard buzzing in my ears, I said no. I denied it. Why did I deny it? I don't, maybe you can tell me, Chris, but I don't know why I denied it. I think I denied it because it's another manifestation of protecting my world. Do you hear noises in your head, Mr. Shea? It's not a question you want to answer a yes to. You don't want to be Joan of Arc looking for a job at Mobile Corporation.
I know lots of people who've had tinnitus. I've had it myself from time to time. I know it. I've talked to my doctor about it and found other people who've suffered it. And then sort of it passes. But I don't know. Denying it is something else.
When it's identified to you, yeah, it is something else. When I finally got the hearing aids and I realized that the external world was making a lot more sound than I realized, and the tinnitus was identifiable because it largely disappears when you wear hearing aids, because those are the internal head sounds that you get. It's probably the efferent nerve fibers coming from the brain to the ear that make those noises. But when I realized that there was a world without those noises, or at least with them being less pronounced, it brought me to tears. And it was a very, very difficult year getting over the problem of that noise, which I thought was natural before, but realized was different from the natural world after the hearing aids. Finally, as you say, though, the pain, the emotional pain went away, and I'm accustomed to it, but the noises are still constantly there.
It fascinates me, Jerry Shea, that even at Yale, when you were having trouble following the lectures or hearing them in their language, you were a very successful singer, a hearty singer. You rose to the top of Yale a cappella singing in the Whiffen Booths, Poor Little Lambs Who Have Lost Our Way, and all that stuff. By the tables down at Morey's, place music in this world of distorted sound.
Well, music is a lot less precise than speech is. I mean, consonants are the markers of our speech, and they're very high-frequency sounds. Music for me in the pre-hearing aid days were all low sounds, but they were beautiful sounds, and in a sense, I could appreciate those sounds as much as any normally hearing person. In a sense, they were my connection. They're even more so today. To the hearing world. And in singing a cappella, here's another example of not figuring things out. When the pitch pipe would give the pitch for a particular song, I would always have to wait for the other singers to come in before I could start the song myself. Once again, another example of I thought was simply a shortcoming on my part. So I could always sing naturally once I got the note and sing with others. I would oftentimes stick out. I had trouble blending my voice with the others, but that seemed to me like a natural problem. Lots of people have that problem. But my I was always very sensitive to movements and speech, and I could even, and to vowels. I could, for example, there was one song that we sang in the group before the Whiffs called The Duke's Men, called The New Frontier, built around my impersonation of John F. Kennedy. And it was a great song. You know, Jack is the king of the new frontier. Jack is the fellow who makes folks cheer. Massachusetts' favorite son, Harvard's moved to Washington. And then they would go and they'd sing those lyrics and others, real lyrics, and then hum. They'd hum, "Oh, we love the walls of ivy that surround the new frontier." And I would go on with my Kennedy impersonation, which I could give you a version of right now if you'd like to hear it.
Try it, please.
"We are now on the brink of a new frontier. But the frontier of which I speak is not a set of promises. It is a set of challenges. The Republican Party, as we all know, is the party of the past." Voila. So I could do that. I could imitate Cardinal Cushing. I could imitate, Cushing and Kennedy were my two best. But I could watch people carefully. I knew what their consonants were. I could pronounce them. I got their vowels and the tones of their voice down. And that is all part of music. And I think in a way, because I'm such a happy person, I really do love life, that the solution to my problem was to sing or to laugh or to change the subject or to walk away or whatever. I mean, there were lots of, and I always thought, for example, that if you're thinking about normality in hearing, loud noises, as all doctors know, are anathema to the hard of hearing. But in my case, and they were to me, the noise of a siren, the noise of a truck, the noise of the subway in New York, I would have to block my ears. And this led me to believe, to the extent I thought about hearing this in those days, that I had an incredibly keen hearing. And that because I was so talented, if you will, or able musically, that was another sign of how keen my hearing was. What I didn't realize musically was that I was not hearing the violins and the flutes and the piccolos. And once I did hear those in later life with hearing aids, that was an emotional moment.
On this matter of music, a partly deaf man who's also a very good singer, it reminded me of a favorite passage in Proust where Marcel is at a chamber music concert, and it's music that he knows intensely and loves profoundly, and he's just beside himself with his excitement. And then there's an intermission, and people want to talk about all sorts of nonsense, and he's so sort of outraged that the language of chatter in Paris in his time was so banal, so distracting, and the music was so sublime. So he has this reflection. He's wondering whether music might not be the unique example of what might have been if the invention of language, the formation of words, the analysis of ideas had not intervened. It might have been, music might have been the means of communication between souls. He puts sort of musical expression and musical messaging somehow on a higher plane than words even. And in some sense, it's the spirit of your book.
I think it is on a higher plane. Mendelssohn himself, I took my title of the book, Song Without Words, from his pieces called Songs Without Words. When someone wanted to provide the words to the music, he said, "No, don't do that, because it already has its own definite message, and all music does." And I think it is a message that is on a higher plane with words. Although in the book itself, what I've tried to do is to create a kind of music with the words, whether it's the lyricals or the description of sign language, so that the words in the book have a meaning beyond the four corners of the definitions you find in the dictionary. And I think that is, in a way, the result of my effort to express myself as a person who is really not wholly a part of the hearing world. My way of saying, look, listen to the music of the words that we all speak and that you hear well and I don't, and look how beautiful they can be when they're expressed within the finite vocabulary of the human language.
I want to come back to this matter of your membership in the hearing world and the non-hearing world and some of the subtle differences. But first, there are moments in your story that I'd love you just to recount, Gerald Shay, including the mobile test when the Mobil Oil Company, because their chairman had had a hearing problem, tested everybody, and you confronted the hard news. And then tell us about this Dr. Chang, who embraced you, but told you that you had to deal with something here.
Well, at the mobile test, as I mentioned, the nurse told me I pressed the button 5 times and she rang 20 tones. And
you missed 15, in other words.
I missed 15 tones, that's right. And I denied that I had noises in my head, and I went for a whole year without doing anything. Finally, I got tested, and I was comparing other people's minutes of meetings that I attended with what I'd heard, and made the connection with what the nurse had said, and went to a doctor up here in Massachusetts when I was visiting my mother in Salem, and he thought I had a brain tumor because I'd been involved in such a intense, linguistically so involved as a lawyer for so many years, and he suggested I see a neurologist. But I went back to New York, suggested I see right away, like it was Friday. He said, go and see him on Monday. But instead, I went to the head of the ENT at Columbia's College of Physicians and Surgeons to see Dr. Chang. He got my records from the audiologist and took me through the difficulty. It was an intentionally emotional session with Dr. Chang, and he figured out that the problem that I had had was a problem I'd had for a long, long time. He watched the way I looked at him, the way I looked at his lips. He turned away at one point, and I couldn't get it. And then he opened the curtains, and the light came in behind his lips, and I couldn't get it. And I finally got it being the message that I was really a different person, that my life had been, very much composed of nonsense, lyricals, but nonsense in a professional context. And I broke down, and Dr. Chang came around his desk and put his arms around me and encouraged me to just face it. Not to succeed as a high-powered lawyer. Look, this is not a problem. Get your hearing aids. I said, are the hearing aids going to help? And he said, well, look, we're all mortal, and maybe they'll help, and maybe they won't. But he didn't say now you know yourself or anything like that. He said it was important to know yourself, but he was really wonderful. And every time I think of the problem, certainly in the professional context, I think of my session with Chang and how much support he gave me, how well he understood the problem, and what a humanist he was.
Mm. Praise God. There's a humanism, Jerry, in this book that just overwhelms me at times. But Dr. Chang also said a very significant thing. He looked at you and he said, Jerry, you're so very, very tired.
Yeah, and I was. Very tired because you, in law school, the lectures in law school, I would write down the wrong words, move to the front of the room, and then at night, I had an office in law school. I worked for Professor Gerbel, leading legal historian, and after my work for him, from say 8 until 1 or 2 in the morning, I would translate my notes and reread the case. But when I finally went to Debevoise and Plimpton, my law firm. That system was not going to work, and I would have to try to translate what was going on in the evening and really not get what was going on at the meetings, even for contracts I drafted. So, as you can imagine, Chris, that was an exhausting experience, and I was exhausted. I was very tired, and I had indeed been very sick.
And one of the partners in your firm had sort of overheard you in the lavatory saying when you thought you were alone, I'd rather be dead. I mean, here's a very successful young man in a hugely prestigious law firm saying, I want out of here.
Well, I was taking medication for my ulcers, which developed pretty quickly at the office, and I took Valium to calm my nerves. This is before Dr. Chang, a Valium to calm my nerves and probanthine to get the liquids out of the system, and Mylanta to coat the stomach, and then coffee to counteract the Valium. And I was in the bathroom that day taking Mylanta, and I looked at myself in the mirror. I looked a mess. I was exhausted. And I said out loud, I wish I were dead. I thought I was alone. And when you're thinking thoughts like that, it's better to say them because they make them less threatening. But then when I turned around to walk out of the John, I saw the shiny black shoes of Silas Parkman, the presiding partner of the firm, very, very agitated. So Silas knew that something was wrong.
Then comes the moment when you get the hearing aids. And I'd love you just to talk about the rebirth of crickets in your life.
Yes, well, I got the hearing aids, and I at first didn't believe that they worked. And then at a meeting in Arabia, the first meeting of my life, I was 34 years old, talking to an accounting guy from Ernst & Young about the Saudi tax law. It was Mobil's. Mobil had enormous projects in Saudi Arabia. And I understood what this man, he was an Iraqi named Walid Shorbachi, I understood what he said. And he went through it with me. His mother also had hearing problems, and he was very gentle, and I understood it and wrote a memorandum, and it was the first accurate recounting of a conversation I'd ever done in my life. But the magic of the hearing aids I discovered when I got back to New York, and we rented a house. Claire, my wife and I were going out together then. We rented a house in Millbrook, in Field. We rented from Sam Shaw, who was descended from General Shaw, whose statue is in the Boston Common.
Robert Gould Shaw.
So Sam rented us his house for almost nothing, I think, for 7 weeks for $500. And that Friday night, I was out in the field, and I had my hearing aids on my glasses on. They were glasses then, and they were turned off. I had my Friday night gin and tonic. And suddenly out in that field, I felt as if I were not alone. And for some reason, I turned on the hearing aids to find out who else might be there. I was alone. Claire was in the house. Others were in the house. And suddenly I heard the sound of crickets coming from everywhere. And I turned around to listen to them. And it was a beautiful, beautiful sound that I had not heard since I was a child. But I remembered them. And it was a further awakening for me as to who I was and as to the world I was really living in. They were also music for me. And music itself came back in the form of the violins and the flutes. And as I say in the book, I do remember listening to Peter and the Wolf when I was 5 years old. I had scarlet fever when I was six. And listening to Peter and the Wolf, Peter now rivals the Wolf in Prokofiev, and once more, I become a child again. It was like Proust's Madeleine, except that these Madeleine were permanently gone from my life. I mean, throughout his life, Proust could always have a Madeleine and think back to those moments. In my case, I didn't have the Madeleines of those crickets and music until I was 34 years old.
As you write, the wind in the willows of your life was restored, and I love your citations of Kenneth Graham and The Wind in the Willows, and Rat telling Mole, "There it is again, O Mole, the beauty of it, the merry bubble and joy, the thin, clear, happy call of the distant piping, such music I never dreamed of."
Yes, absolutely. And when you read those words, when I read those words of Kenneth Graham, they mean something special to me, because that thin, clear call has really become the heart of my life. And it's interesting what Graham says when he talks about the call of it. I forget the precise words, it's sweeter than the music. But that's also what Mendelssohn was talking about. Mm-hmm. That was the definite message of music that just carries you up with it. And for me, the most beautiful part of my life, if you just think of me as an individual alone, leaving my wife and family outside of it, clearly the most beautiful part of my life is music. And every day I wake up, I start by singing a song. Even out here, when I swim out here in the cove in Marblehead, I go out there at 8 o'clock in the morning and try to think of a song I might like to sing. It could be a song with terrific words. Like, if you take the words to, I don't know who wrote the song, but I'll be seeing you in all the old familiar places that this heart of mine embraces all day through. In that small cafe, the park beside the way, the children's carousel, the wishing well. So the words too, I can now, of course, when I sing them myself, I know what I'm singing, but music, whether singing alone or playing the piano or writing some simple compositions is along with writing, the heart of my life. Maybe it always was. Probably was.
Speak a little bit more about that special quality of music in the lives of deaf people.
I'll start with sign language. When you look at the profoundly deaf people who hear virtually nothing signing to each other, and sign language is there are many, many sign languages in the world. Each country or region has its own, like speech. Because there's no natural relationship between words or signs and the things or thoughts they represent. When you see signing people, profoundly deaf, signing to each other, it looks as if they're conducting their own separate symphonies, and it's a beautiful thing to watch. Mm. This is their music. And if you look, but it's a precise music. It's as precise as our language. And if you look at the profoundly deaf and blind, those who are both deaf and blind signing to each other, they do it by holding hands. It's the sign language of the deaf modified for their blindness, and they look like they're composing a single symphony of their own. And it's a beautiful thing to behold. And it's interesting to note that for the profoundly deaf who sign, that is their language, the language comes, they speak what I call the language of light. And that language comes to them through light and through their eyes. But what's fascinating about it is that when they see the other person signing, it's a linguistic exercise, just as complex as our spoken language. And that message goes from their eyes to the auditory cortex of the brain. And it's there that those signs are interpreted. So they are really hearing, like you and I, the partially deaf too. And when the deaf-blind touch and sign to each other, the message comes to them through touch, but also goes to the auditory cortex of the brain. So we are all really hearing, even though we are in the language of air, the molecules of air carry our message, and the signers are in the language of light or the language of tough touch for those who are deaf-blind.
And for this, we credit the amazing plasticity of the brain, which sort of helps its various sectors out. The visual cortex remains active even in blind people. And you're saying the auditory cortex works. Something's going on in there even for deaf people.
That's right. That's right. The linguistic interpretive centers of the brain are functioning for them just as they do for us.
There's a marvelous moment in your book, Jerry Shea, where you're watching a signing actress, Emmanuelle Labarie, I believe, and she's doing that absolutely incredible speech of Cordelia in King Lear, in which she's explaining to her father that were she to marry, she would have to give her new lord half the love that she had reserved for her father. It's an amazing speech of very short, simple words. She's beginning, you have begot me, bred me, loved me. I return those duties back as a right fit, obey you, love you, and must honor you. She asks, why have my sister's husbands, if they say they love you all, happily when I shall wed that lord whose hand must take my plight, shall carry half my love with him, half my care and duty. Can you describe the power of that in sign?
Seeing Emmanuelle Labarie sign those words for me were a terribly moving experience, because I had read her book, which is called The Cry of the Gull, Le Cri de la Mouette, in which she describes her life being raised orally as a profoundly deaf child, being taught to lip read and being taught to speak, which is a virtual impossibility. And finally, her father realized it wasn't working, and he took her to see two Americans who were teaching sign language in Paris. And before, Emmanuelle didn't even know she had a name, and she didn't know other people had names either. And when she went to see them, she was amazed that a deaf man could understand her father's words in the hands of a deaf signer, a hearing signer. And she realized that she had found her own language, and she began to sign herself. Mama, this is Mama. This is Papa. I am Emmanuel. I have a name. And then when I saw her signing in the play at the IVT in Paris, these are wonderful plays that she does where deaf actors who sign, their parts are spoken, and then speaking parts are signed by other characters. But because I am really not a part of either, I'm part of the hearing world, certainly, but not a full-fledged member at all of that world. I'm a partially in, partially out. I couldn't hear the messages of the spoken words, and I couldn't. I know a little bit of sign, but certainly haven't. I studied it for the book, but I'm not a signer. Couldn't understand the sign either, but I knew what the play was about, and I knew when the speech was coming, and I'd read the play the night before, and of course I read them again afterwards. And Emmanuelle Laborie became a human being. I mean... Mm. Her language was her soul. She didn't have it until she was about 10 years old. And it's a beautiful thing to see for the partially deaf, because the profoundly deaf have a language that is complete. And they are, in a sense, better off than we are, because even though their world is more constrained, they're living amongst other signing people. They can express themselves fully across the table. They can understand what other people are saying, and they are full and complete human beings. They don't have music, but they have music of their language, the music of their language. We, the partially deaf, are constantly playing a guessing game, and whereas they go directly to the message, we have to go through lots of alternatives because they're using their eyes, and the message goes right to the auditory cortex, and we're using our imperfect ears and our eyes to try to decipher speech. In a way, we're in the wrong medium with our eyes. And our lives are more complex than those of the profoundly deaf. And there have been times, as when I saw Emmanuel and tried to listen to the parts that were spoken and watched her sign, there are times that you know, when I wished I were deaf and had the language that they have, but I don't.
Jerry Shea, you open up in the book, Song Without Words, a lot of fine distinctions, important distinctions about ways to communicate for the deaf and the partially deaf. Among other things, you share the hindsight that Helen Keller, who learned to speak with words, sound, not perfect by a long shot, but may have been misguided, may have been... pointed the wrong way when she could have discovered sign that came more truly from where she was, the real language of the deaf being sign, not an adopted, highly contrived spoken word. You talk about wanting to be deaf in a fashion. You also talk about a kind of hatred among the partially deaf for people with full range who can move so swiftly, so facilely, you know, while you're just getting out of the gate.
Everybody must have, Chris, the language they need. That to me is a primordial principle. In Helen Keller's case, she could never really speak comprehensively, and she communicated through fingerspelling, but not by touching people's lips, but by having Annie Sullivan spell words into her hand. And as you can imagine, that's a very difficult way to communicate. I-A-M-H-A-V-I-N-G-A-V-E-R-Y-N-I-C-E. T-I-M-E with you today here on this program, it's very difficult to communicate like that. Helen's natural language was sign language, the language of touch, and if she had it, she would have been she would have done so much more for the world of the deaf. Instead of writing about the colors of silver streams and purple mountains, which she had no understanding at all of, the buzzing of bees, so we all need that language. The partially deaf, too, must have the language they need. The problem is that we have trouble getting the message right away. There's an awful lot of effort that goes into lip reading. It's an imperfect exercise. Some sounds sound alike, like the P, the B, look alike. The P, the B, and the M, you can't really tell them apart. The F and the V, you can't tell apart. And the consonants are the markers of our speech. They're the creators of our lyricals. And when you're in a conversation with one other person, you can watch his lips and keep up pretty well. And when you're close to them, very well, as I am with you here, so close, and with the light on your lips. But if two hearing people are talking together and you're in the conversation, you're very quickly going to get lost. And conversation has a way of taking up the pace of those who are the quickest communicators. So if we extrapolate from that to negotiations, for example, where around a large table people are talking to each other, you pretty quickly feel excluded. Now, when I didn't know what the problem was, still thought it was some sort of spiritual or intellectual shortcoming, I was troubled by that and focused on my own inadequacies. But when I got hearing aids and realized that the problem, which continues, of course, because there are just louder sounds going into imperfect ears, you get the feeling that the hearing is the enemy, as you say, because they are all speaking at their own pace and leaving you rapidly behind. And there are moments where really it's fair to say that you hate them.
But then at the end of your book, you make a kind of decision about your life. You're going to quit the law and in effect join the world of the deaf or partially deaf. It is sort of from one gang or one club or one political party into another. It's not a political party, but what is it, this world of the deaf that you wanted to join as your place?
I'm not sure I really thought about joining the world of the partially deaf. What I realized I had to do was that I really needed to change my life, that the pressures of negotiations on major transactions with loads of people in the room and switching from, I mean, at that point I graduated to so-called omnidirectional microphones and hearing aids and FM systems that would get the message to my ears. But if a client on the left or right of me wanted to whisper something, I'd have to turn off the microphone and listen to him and watch him with my hearing aids as the conversation went on. And, you know, that became very, very difficult. The pressures were absolutely enormous, and I would have to pull people after meetings to find out what happened. And all this time being paid, or the firm being paid, you know, a fortune per hour, there was an ethical problem too. But the key problem probably was the stress that it caused me. No ulcers anymore, because I knew what the problem was. The ulcers came from not knowing. But I finally decided that I really needed to do something else, that I really would not, as I said to Claire, would not come home one night. I would just, you know, collapse with a heart attack or a stroke. I was discovering myself, and I really began to think at that point, how on earth did I ever get so far in life professionally? But I decided right away, almost at that moment, that it was time to look forward and not back, and try to find my place in life and my place with music, certainly, but also with words, and trying to turn those words, those written words, into music.
In your own experience, Gerald Shea, what happens in a good conversation, and what makes it work?
I'd say what happens in a good conversation for me is my understanding of it. It's not a very exciting response, but to understand, for me, to understand what a person is saying to me today with hearing aids and being close to them, sound diminishes exponentially with distance. So if you're close to a person, you can get the message much more clearly. That is the magic of a conversation. And it may be, Chris, that the partially deaf are different from those who hear well, because you can talk to other people and you get the words very easily, so you can focus on their emotions. Are we getting along? What am I going to ask him next? How is this working? What kind of a person is, how is he moving? What kind of a person is this? Whereas we, the partially deaf, don't really focus so much, at least not consciously, on those things, because we're spending so much time getting the words. Conversation for me is not really normal conversation with hearing people is not a happy time for me. It's a time for problem solving and for figuring out riddles. The happy time for me is when I'm playing the piano or singing or trying to make words into music to the extent that I can. So maybe that is, maybe I'm discovering myself a little bit here. Maybe that is the world of the partially deaf into which I have, you know, in which I now find myself.
It's a good conversation in which anybody discovers something about himself or herself. Let me just say, one of the exciting things about this incredible book, Gerald Shea, is just the sense of discovering an affliction that you or we didn't know we had. I mean, suddenly opening up the window and seeing life in full color and not having realized that you were seeing it in some sort of sepia diminished tone or something. Finding a new identity in midlife and then really fleshing it out. May we all go through these things, right?
We do in different ways. So we all create our own universes.
This reminds me of the doctor that you meet in Louisiana, who's a psychiatrist, but he was a surgeon before that, quit surgery because he realized he was deaf and he was missing communications in the operating room and it couldn't go on. But he was the one who told you, I think, that there's a life beyond lyricals and you can get there. You can change your life, as the man said.
He did say that. That was an important moment in my life. This was late in my professional career, very shortly before I made my own personal decision. The omnidirectional microphones weren't working. The hearing aids weren't working. I was you know, working the lyricals late into night, trying to guess the next day's lyricals. And I went down to Louisiana to see this doctor who spoke to me about things in general. And I told him life was hell. He finally said, you know, Jerry, you can't make your whole life a lyrical. He didn't go far beyond that, but what he really meant was that you have a life, a complex life in which you are, your language is words, and not really the written word so much as the spoken word. You're a negotiator, and you can't hear well, and you put yourself in an impossible position. Don't make your life a lyrical. You, Jerry Shea, have really got to find your own way.
You know that Rilke line in a poem about the torso of Apollo, I think, but he says, out of the blue, you must change your life. And your book sort of follows up and says, in effect, you can too.
Yes, you can.
Jerry Shea, you've written a book like none other that I can remember reading in a long, long time, with perhaps an exception for Oliver Sacks's book on musicophilia and his book on neurological breakthroughs and miracles. Song Without Words, Discovering My Deafness Halfway Through Life, is a book for everybody, and it's so beautifully written. I can't thank you enough for the book, Jerry Shea, and for this conversation.
And thank you, Chris. You're wonderful.
Mary McGrath produced and edited this conversation with Gerald Shea. His book, Song Without Words. The conversation isn't over until you, the listener, join with a comment on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the project.